You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
All right, well, our next guest is somebody who we've heard about a lot from listeners. Every time a commercial comes on from Chuck Collins talking about patriotic millionaires and wealth inequality in our country, we hear people saying, you should get him on as a guest. And so we're going to. But I'm going to get there by way of a personal tale. As folks know, I'm traveling this week. And down here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, I spent yesterday afternoon down at the Fort Worth Stockyards, where you had both Swift and Armor were the two big meatpacking plants down here. They later combined as Swift Armor. We all know what kinds of kids eat Armor hot dogs. And then, of course, people know about Oscar Mayer and how, you know, once upon a time worked in, I believe, the Chicago Stockyards for both Swift and Armor before starting a little company of his own. And his grandson, Chuck Collins, is one of those folks who should be part of the family dynasty, the wealth that comes along with it. But Chuck has seen the world and has decided to use his life to point out the wealth inequality and the widening gap here in the world, starting with families who maybe acquired wealth, but then it's what they've done in trying to protect the wealth and grow the wealth that has really had negative impacts on our society, on our politics, and on our planet. And so it is an honor to welcome Chuck Collins to the program this morning. Chuck, good morning. Thank you for being here. How are you?
Good morning, Pat. Thank you for having me. And I should say my wife taunts me by singing that Armor
I sang it to my daughter and grandkids yesterday, and it just didn't resonate with them the way that it did, or the old Oscar Mayer jingles for that matter. But you know, you come from that Oscar Mayer family, and you talk in your book Burned by Billionaires, and thank you again for the copy to peruse before the interview here. You talk about the, I guess I would say, the old-timey companies, you know, the Carnegies, the Vanderbilts, the Rockefellers, and we're all familiar with the Gilded Age of that time. And it seems like more people than ever, but still not nearly enough people, understand just what a Gilded Age we've entered with this new generation of family wealth.
Yeah, we are living through an extraordinary growth of wealth inequality in the U.S. And it's pretty much taken over 40 years to get to this point. You know, for people who grew up in the years after World War II, we were kind of growing together. The middle class was expanding. And then in the late 70s, we made this turn and we've become more and more unequal. And I would say most of the wealth and income now, it's not just growing to the top 1%, it's going to that top 0.1%, the folks with $40 million. So that's the time we're living in, extreme inequality.
And it's like you said in the book, and you make a great point about this, it's one thing to acquire wealth. And a lot of Americans, frankly, don't begrudge that. If you've built yourself from virtually nothing into something, okay, that's one thing. And then maybe some people are familiar with the next stage of how you protect that wealth and, you know, looking for the tax shelters and the corporate acquisitions and all that. But it's these next two phases that I think people are less familiar with, basically about, you know, regulatory capture, if you will, but then wealth extraction. Can you talk more about those stages and, you know, where you think we're at right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us respect people who start companies and create something useful and are rewarded financially for that. But as you say, Pat, there's a stage where then once people get a certain level of wealth, and I would say it's sort of around that 40 million mark, they start to invest in wealth defense and they invest in what I would call billionaire capture, the capture of our political system, influencing the writing of rules, policies, laws, kind of in their favor. So the wealthy use their wealth to get more wealth. And then we're in this final stage, and this is the most complicated to understand, where the ultra wealthy are starting to say, well, how can we extract more wealth from the healthy real economy. And I call that, we're living through the hyper-extractive phase, where every corner of our lives, healthcare, housing, how our pets are taken care of, everything, there are these billionaire-backed private equity companies coming in and sort of hoovering up the wealth. Perfectly profitable companies they're buying sometimes, but they just want higher and higher returns. So that's kind of the complicated moment we're in.
Oh, well, and hoovering is the perfect way to put it. And again, it seemed like a relatively small amount of people understood in the beginning that this isn't just about protecting some tax loopholes and, oh, good for them, they don't have to pay as high a percentage of taxes as we do. But it really has gone beyond that to coming up with these ways to basically have that wealth transfer. You know, the thing that a lot of conservatives said was actually happening was there was this transfer of wealth from hardworking people to, you know, lazy people on their couches, when if any of that was going on, it is a pittance compared to the wealth transfer going from the middle class to the, you know, the millionaire billionaire class these days.
Yeah, no, we've been researching this for 20 years now. And what we've seen is just what you're describing. The middle class, people who used to be able to save money, purchase a home, are locked into rental housing, deeper in debt. Wages have pretty much stayed flat. And as they rise, so have the cost of living. So people are more and more squeezed. And that is a result, I would say. And most people say, ah, does it matter how rich the rich are? Do I really care? I don't begrudge them that. But actually, it really matters, because huge amounts of that wealth is going to that top 0.1%. And it's really affecting each of our pocketbooks.
And you say that it has impact not just on society, not just on our politics, but frankly, the planet as well. There is a tipping point at which you have so much wealth concentrated in such a way that it is literally bad for our health and the planet's health.
Yeah, no, you know, it's bad for our physical health. And then, you know, the ultra wealthy are the super polluters, the super emitters. They have bigger houses, they're burning more fuel, they're flying in private jets. Some of them have yachts, which are like the most polluting form of transportation in the world. Again, we're not begrudging individual behavior. We're just saying, look, that's affecting us. We're subsidizing that as taxpayers. We're subsidizing private jets flying around, and they're trashing the planet. And, you know, each of us sort of maybe are wrestling with, well, should I do a little bit more in my own life? But we feel like chumps when we see, you know, somebody flying in their private jet to go have lunch with their friend. You know, it's like, why should I give up anything to have a healthy planet when these folks are reckless?
I was actually just having a conversation down here yesterday with somebody who works in, you know, the private pilot world, and the, you know, the ways that these jets are used. It's not just a family going down to the Cayman Islands. It's, you know, I miss my pet, and so we're flying a family pet across country. It's that kind of, you know, it goes some well beyond luxury. And I'm noticing a similarity to something we talked about in the last hour about the taxpayer funded voucher school program, and how it's not that people are against private schools. It's that they're realizing how much of their money is going into it. So they're not saying shut down the private schools, but they are saying, why are we paying this much for it? Similarly, you're not making the case, oh, we got to get rid of billionaires. We've got to cause harm. We've got to make them lose their wealth. You're saying, no. It's the system, and find a way that we don't put as much of our money, or frankly, as much of our political power into the hands of just a few concentrated wealthy families.
I think that's a really important point, Pat. It's not about individuals and individual behavior, although I can think of a few annoying billionaires out there.
Yes.
But there's actually a few decent folks who care about the problems you and I are talking about. It's about a system. It's about how the economy's kind of been rewired over the last couple of decades to funnel wealth to the top and not lift the floor and expand our middle class. And that's when it's really, really backfires, I think, on the health of the society. So it's an opportunity for us to say, well, you know, I don't resent individuals. I you know, some of us would like to be wealthier, but at this stage, these billionaires are blocking opportunity for everyone else to have just even a decent life, let alone become wealthy.
Chuck Collins is our guest from Patriotic Millionaires and author of the book Burned by Billionaires. And again, has ties to, the Oscar Mayer family and as a result, talk all about wealth inequality and how it has become exacerbated in the current system. So if we're not talking about going after individuals, but more about the system, and yet the system feels like it's been captured by, the super wealthy, then where is our starting point? We can't change the Supreme Court tomorrow and get rid of Citizens United, which has played an outsized role in putting so much corporate cash into our politics. So where do we start to affect change in the very system itself that has been, for lack of a better term, hijacked?
Yeah. Well, this is the pickle we're in. And I would say, let's all look at where we do have some room to move. For instance, at the state and local level, we can sort of do things that protect the health of our local economies. We can protect local hospitals from private equity funds, billionaires buying them up. I'm involved in where I live in New England now, trying to keep our local hospitals from being snatched up by these wealth extractors. We want to elect people who say, hey, I'm going to work for the growth of the benefit of everyone, not the billionaire class, and really measure them. And the more we start to see people run for office and saying, I'm running because I want to lift up everybody, not just the yachts. I want to lift up all the boats, not just the yachts. And they defeat some of these folks who keep voting for tax cuts for the rich. That's going to change the conversation and change the politics. But part of it is we just need to talk to our neighbors about, that problem, your local property tax bill, why it's so high, it's because the billionaires have been shifting taxes off of themselves and onto states and localities for decades, and we're having to pay more because of that.
Well, it is so much easier to talk about a flat tax and the quote unquote fairness of a flat tax rather than trying to explain marginal tax rates and why we would be so much better off, with making the tax system as non-flat as possible. But somehow or another, we have to try that because this getting away from a progressive tax system, taxation system, it has got to be right at the top of the list of things that need to be fixed.
Absolutely. And most people agree with that. Most people understand the billionaires aren't even paying their end of the flat tax, let alone paying a progressive tax that used to be in place. I live in Vermont, so my senior senator used to says things like, under the socialist presidency of Dwight Eisenhower, we used to tax the wealthy at high rates and invest in education, infrastructure, affordable housing, things that lift up everybody, not just the rich. And I think that's probably we need to kind of rekindle that conversation again.
Oh, without a doubt. And hopefully with more in that style of speech, it resonates with people, as we found out when Senator Sanders was here in Wisconsin, not that very long ago. Chuck Collins, again, the book is Burned by Billionaires. You should be looking for that. And of course, you hear him here across the Civic Media Radio Network, thanks to Patriotic Millionaires. And I'm sure we'll be hearing more from you in the coming days as well. Chuck, thank you so much for your time this morning. It was a real pleasure.
Thanks, Pat, and thanks to your listeners for listening in.
You bet. All right. Appreciate it very much. We will have some final news and notes from down here in Dallas coming up in just a bit. And of course, a reminder that we've got Brewers playoff baseball coming up later this afternoon. It will be the Brewers versus the Cubs. Brewers could conceivably clinch the National League Division Series and move on in the postseason. Pregame starting at 3:30. Back in just a bit.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back. It is a little chilly up north on this Tuesday morning, October 7th. Ooh, October 7th, before I forget. Happy birthday, Mom. There we go. Won't be in the doghouse today. It is 32 degrees right now in Hayward, in Manitowish Waters, and in Tomahawk. It's 45 in the Chippewa Valley, 48 in La Crosse, 43 in Wisconsin Rapids, and the warm spot across Wisconsin, basically the entire southeast corner, is hovering around 55 degrees right now. Tomorrow on the program, while I'm here in Texas, I'm going to be talking to a member of a group that fights for fair funding for public schools, threatened by the explosive growth of taxpayer-funded vouchers for private schools. It's a big, growing problem in Wisconsin. It's a much bigger problem here in Texas, where I guess everything is supposedly bigger, including the crisis facing public schools. And so we'll talk to a member of a national education group about what lessons from Texas can we take to Wisconsin. Also tomorrow, we'll talk to Chuck Collins from Patriotic Millionaires and his new book about how concentrated wealth and power are ruining lives and the planet. But let's take a couple of minutes here to talk about the latest attacks on free elections in the United States, because despite still no evidence of widespread election fraud and a constant stream of legal rulings that affirm voting rights, far-right extremists are not giving up trying to make voting more difficult in Wisconsin. I got three examples for you. There's the Waukesha County judge, yes, Waukesha County, who just ordered the Wisconsin Elections Commission to check the citizenship status of millions of people on the voter registration rolls, a massive undertaking with no clear method, much less any evidence of its necessity. The State Department of Justice is asking the judge to put the order on hold for the moment to figure out what it would mean and how to go about verifying the citizenship of 3.6 million registered Wisconsin voters before the next election in February, as ordered by Waukesha County Judge Michael Maxwell. Now, such a move, according to State Attorney General Josh Call, would require a massive overhaul of the state's voter registration system and create new verification requirements that are not otherwise provided for in state law. And further, the judge doesn't explain what it would entail to verify that an applicant to register to vote is a U.S. citizen. For example, do you check someone against a driver's license database? Well, what if they don't drive? None of this is spelled out, because none of it is necessary. There's no mechanism for this, because it's a solution in search of a problem. It is a thinly, oh so thinly veiled effort to engage in racial profiling of American voters who don't look like, say, typical voters in Waukesha County. Frankly, it's sick. And we'll see how this goes during what will certainly be an appeals process. Example number two, there are some Republican legislators once again circulating a bill that would again ban absentee ballot drop boxes, which again have shown no security concerns. The eight Republicans behind the bill are using language similar to President Trump in their co-sponsorship memo, saying that Wisconsin voters deserve to have trust in the mechanisms and processes that our state employs in conducting its elections. Yeah, and we have that now. We've had that with ballot drop boxes that had been supported by Republicans as well as Democrats in the past, until Donald Trump tried to overturn his 2020 election loss and blamed drop boxes and mail-in voting despite no evidence. In fact, the closest thing we have to an issue with a drop box in Wisconsin is from a drop box opponent, the mayor of Wausau, who you'll recall removed a box outside of City Hall that was not yet in use for the 2024 presidential election. And then third, we have Senator Ron Johnson and a story coming out yesterday as he cries out about being investigated for his contributions that were intended to undermine the 2020 election results. Now, according to a story in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Republican senators said yesterday that they had discovered that Ron Johnson and six other senators' phone data was obtained by the FBI as special counsel Jack Smith investigated the efforts to overturn the election. Johnson and the others expressed shock. Shock, I tell you, with Johnson saying, "We were surveilled simply for being Republicans." No, you weren't. You were rightly investigated for helping the guy who lost the election try to undermine or even overturn its results. You can't hide what the record shows, and the record shows that you would have been, Ron Johnson, moments away from being a mule delivering fraudulent ballots from fake electors if only Vice President Mike Pence had gone along with the plot. And just a couple of weeks prior to that, you, Senator Johnson, were holding hearings so that all manner of conspiracy theorists could trot out claims, all without evidence. You knew exactly what you were doing. You knew exactly what Trump and his cronies were doing. And now you have the audacity to feign outrage. Well, let's be clear about something. It will never not enrage me that we have the pieces in place to hold accountable the people who tried to overturn an election, basically stage a coup. And for various reasons, they got away with it. And they got back in power. And they're still getting away with activities that undermine American democracy. It just leads you to wonder, what does it say about a party that is so afraid of election outcomes that it will stop at nothing to put up roadblocks to voting? It should be the thing that anybody engaged in public service wants to encourage, especially when you have a system that already has the guardrails in place for elections to be secure and safe for every qualified voter. But there are too many people in our political system today who don't want every qualified voter to vote, just the ones that they choose. On the way, we are going to have today's history lesson, including John Cougar or John Mellencamp or John Cougar, whatever he's going by. It's his birthday today. That and more in today's history lesson coming up next. I'm Pat Kreitlow. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back. Brewers Cubs tonight. First pitch after 8 p.m. The pregame begins at 7:35 on Civic Media stations in Richland Center, Oshkosh, Racine, Park Falls, and Hayward. Be sure to tune in. You can also sign up for Civic Media's new daily newsletter. It's on Substack. Sign up at civicmediatoday.substack.com. And then, of course, here at Up North News, we have a Sunday morning newsletter with an emphasis on politics, including our question of the week. Sign up at upnorthnewswi.com. I basically am asking people this week to be part of our first way too early poll for governor for next year and asking people, you know, who do they support at this point, knowing full well that there's lots of time before the August primary of next year. But we're already getting quite a range of answers. We've got people, let's see, Stephen here says Missy Hughes is my choice. Jack from Merrimack says my personal preference for governor would be Mandela Barnes. Richard says I would vote for Josh Call because he has a track record of fighting for rights and standing up to the White House. Sue H. says Ben Wickler. Lisa says my pick for governor would be Ryan Starnad, not a politician or a white-collar businessman. I think he's got some honest dirt under those fingernails. Let's see, from Herb, my way-too-early pick would be Kelda Royce. Mark says Sarah Rodriguez is my first choice. Len says State Representative Francesca Hong, and on it goes. And so, again, sign up for our newsletter and be among the first to answer our question of the week. All right, our guest for this segment is telling us about, again, some of the types of cuts that are happening. We've talked about on this show before, but again, they just don't feel real. And so we want to talk again about who and why would you be making cuts to programs that help the deafblind community, including deafblind children. Adrian Klenz is the executive director of a group that works with deafblind adults, but can tell us more about the Deafblind Technical Assistance Program for Kids. Adrian is the executive director of the Center for Deafblind Persons and joins us now. Adrian, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. Great. Thanks for the opportunity. Good to be here.
Yeah, well, it's nice to have you here as well. So let me again straighten out the differences between the two groups. We're going to talk about cuts to the Wisconsin Deafblind Technical Assistance Program. Can you talk just a bit about more about what that is and then how that ties into the work you do at the Center for Deafblind Persons?
Sure, absolutely. So as you mentioned, Wisconsin Deafblind Technical Assistance Program, which to shorten it up and make it easier, WDBTAP, is a program that has served deafblind children in the state of Wisconsin since the 1960s. And they help deafblind children and their families basically from birth up to the age of 21. And then once they're 21, that's where the Center for Deafblind Persons can come into play. If they so choose as adults to continue services, then they would come to us. And we have, as you can imagine, a close working relationship with WDBTAP, because as these kids get older and start nearing adulthood, and they start learning about us and our services, sometimes they're referred over to us, and then we start that process of working with them. So it's been a very close working relationship through the years. And as you can imagine, we were quite shocked when we got this news back in kind of late August that this might be happening. And unfortunately, that nightmare continues. As I speak to you today, I literally don't know the status of the program. I've tried to reach out a few times last week and haven't heard back. I know that an appeal was filed, and I have not heard news about what happened with that. So as of right now, we're in a holding pattern as far as what happens for these young folks and their families throughout the state.
And we first heard about this in the context of cuts like this were done, in this case, for WDBTAP, the Wisconsin Deafblind Technical Assistance Program for Deafblind Children. Were those cuts came through the Trump administration that was going after, again, so-called DEI programs, anything that singled out a group for special treatment, they said needed to be cut, and that then those cuts, you know, those programs would be rolled into something else instead that didn't single out a group for special treatment. this is... Okay, this is just wild, but I guess I'll ask it this way, Adrian. Is there a group that deafblind children could be folded into rather than the one that's benefiting them right now?
No. And this is what's frustrating is it's easy to throw around words and say things like that. Like, you know, I saw the statement that said, well, they'll just be absorbed into other programs. There is no other program. And that's the stark reality. And I think people need to understand that. The Wisconsin Deafblind Technical Assistance Program literally is, I believe, 7 staff that were serving 170 families throughout the state of Wisconsin, and they were it. That's the ballgame. Those 7 individuals have the specialized training to help those with dual sensory loss. And let's be clear, that's a unique challenge. It's one thing. I was born with a visual impairment, so I'm 51 years old and I've lived life with a visual impairment. Add to that, now suddenly your hearing is impacted. So both vision and hearing are gone. You need specialized training to help those folks, right? And so there's no one else in the state of Wisconsin that has that training. Just like at the Center for Deafblind Persons, we are the individuals that can work with deafblind adults. So this notion that, they'll just be absorbed in another program. Well, there is no other program. And that's where, you know, people are left adrift. And it's terrifying, quite frankly.
We're talking to Adrian Clenzies, the executive director of the Center for Deafblind Persons, and the technical assistance part of the technical assistance program. Can you talk a bit about that, the adaptive technologies and things that help deafblind children to be able to go to school, get an education, mm-hmm. and get through life?
Absolutely. And you hit the nail on the head there. So you talked about like assistive technology, like this thing here, the phone, we all take for granted. But imagine, again, vision impacted, hearing impacted. And so technology is a wonderful tool, and it continues to develop. And so there are all kinds of resources out there to help deafblind children, deafblind adults be able to interact in day-to-day life, whether it be going to school, your job, just keeping in touch with friends and family. So WDBTAP, along with the Center for Deafblind Persons, we had a collaborative relationship through a program called I Can Connect, which is also a federal program through the FCC. Each state has a program. And in Wisconsin, the Center for Deafblind Persons runs that program. And we worked very closely with WDBTAP. And there were funds that helped deafblind children and their families gain access to this assistive technology, and then training them how to use it, and then offering continued support as issues come up, things break. Sometimes updates come through. You need to learn how to use the technology. And that's what they were able to do. And we also helped them do that. And that's just one little piece of what WDBTAP did. But keep in mind, this isn't also just helping the children and their families. This is helping the educators as well. Because as I said, very few people have this specialized training. So the WDBTAP staff could also work with teachers and teachers' aides and help them to work with these children in the schools. And again, now that's gone. And so then who helps these folks?
So we've got these basically technological marvels, even miracles. I don't think it would be underselling it. And the ability to do things that, you know, the generations prior could scarcely dream of. And unfortunately, in the generations prior, children who were, you know, deaf, blind, or both, and or had other issues, quite often were institutionalized. And we've heard that word a lot lately about other cuts that are coming to Medicaid, to Badger Care, that help with other vulnerable groups. What is the concern for you if deaf, blind children in Wisconsin suddenly no longer have access to the adaptive technology, to the educators, to everybody else, you know, in terms of their own quality of life?
That's a great question. And I mean, if you think about it, I mean, imagine you're on an island and there's no one to help you. And then suddenly you're rescued and then you're put back into society and you don't have any knowledge about what is going on. Like, you're going to be lost. So think of these young children as they're aging from birth up until 21 and they don't have those services. And then suddenly they're adults and it's like, okay, here you go, figure it out. And that's what we're afraid of, because right now, you know, previous to these cuts, you know, WDBTAP was there since the 1960s, helping nurture these young people. And as they got older, if they still needed services, they could come to the center. If that's not there, imagine what kind of shape people are going to be in as they get older and they try to find employment. They want to continue their education. I mean, there's just no support there. So we're very worried about what happens when people come to us, you know, how far behind they're going to be. And we have our own funding challenges. So then, you know, trying to navigate that as well. So it really is very concerning. And I want to make clear, it's very important that people take the time to research and get facts, because I've seen so many, you know, false things stated on social media. Now, recently I was, you know, looking around online and trying to find answers, like, where are things at? And people were posting about, oh, there's, you know, these people or these staff are making so much money and they're only helping three kids. I mean, the average salary, these people, you know, we're talking 40, 50 grand, you know, but they're saying, oh, they're making $150,000 a year and they're only serving three children. No, all these things are not true. And it's important that people have the facts here. You know, the folks that were serving deafblind children, they were not making a lot of money. They're doing this because of the love and passion that they have, and they want to help people. And it just breaks my heart to see the level of misinformation. And again, back to the top, what you were saying, this false notion that, well, they'll just be absorbed elsewhere. No, they fall through the cracks. They're left without services. And the detriment there is just staggering to think about.
Adrian Tony puts a comment up on YouTube. What is the positive vision for this problem? What should be happening? What could be happening? What is, apart from not making the current cuts, what else could be done to keep and improve the current program for deafblind children?
Well, that's a great question. And first of all, I hope that people will make their voice heard and let, you know, legislators know, let the federal government know that these types of cuts are far reaching. And again, I think it's important to recognize we're talking about, for WDBTAP, their budget was $180,000. So this notion that we're talking of millions of dollars is just untrue. And so letting your voice be heard is one thing, so that our elected officials know that, you know, this is not going to be tolerated. I've seen people say, well, why don't you just get donations? Absolutely. I mean, as an executive director for a nonprofit, I've done this for 10 years with two different organizations. Fundraising is huge, and we need support in that realm as well. And we also need to make sure that people have all the facts. As I said, there's so much misinformation going out there. And when you have facts, then people aren't able to, you know, spread rumors. I mean, so we need to get the facts out there that this is a program that helps up to 170 families. this wasn't a huge program, millions of dollars. You know, there's a small staff that we're helping people all over the state. I think those are important things. I mean, I hope people will contribute to nonprofit organizations like the Center for Deafblind Persons or, you know, programs like WDBTAB. It'd be great to be able to move away from the reliance on those dollars. But the reality is there are limited dollars. And so we need that help and support. So if people can donate, if people can make their voice heard, I think that will certainly help. And just making sure that the facts are out there so that there aren't misconceptions that can really be harmful.
Adrian Klintz is the executive director for the Center for Deafblind Persons and talking to us about looming cuts for the Wisconsin Deafblind Technical Assistance Program. Adrian, thank you so very much for all background. It was great to visit with you and wish you all the best going forward.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the opportunity.
You bet. Adrian, thank you very much. We have more coming up in our next hour talking about these looming cuts to healthcare, to Medicaid, and more. We will be talking to Megan Rowe from Opportunity Wisconsin. That's after the 8 o'clock news. I'm Pat Kreitlow. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
At 7:35. Nice to have you along here all across Wisconsin on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Live this week down in Dallas doing some family visits, keeping up on the Wisconsin headlines, and in this segment, adding a bit of a Texas twist to it. Now, we've talked previously to our Courier Newsroom colleagues at Courier Texas about what's happening with public education in Texas and the voucher school program there. We've certainly talked to Cam Stevenson from the Copper Courier in Arizona, and now he's out on Capitol Hill, where again, there's continued pushes to use taxpayer dollars to support private, usually religious schools. And of course, every Wednesday at this time, we talk about public education in Wisconsin, and especially the ongoing threat from a voucher program that is rapidly approaching $1 billion in annual cost to taxpayers. And it still seems like a lot of taxpayers don't know that yet, although they're becoming more and more aware of it each time there's yet another school referendum in Wisconsin. So while I'm here in Texas this week, I thought we should maybe find out what is happening here, and are there things that are happening in Texas that we can take away as lessons to protect public education in Wisconsin. One of the groups working hard on this issue is IDRA. That stands for the Intercultural Development Research Association. And the IDRA deputy director is here now, Dr. Chloe Latham Sykes, and joins us from Austin, Texas. Dr. Sykes, good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, we really appreciate it because, again, you've heard the setup of the problem that we're facing in Wisconsin of helping taxpayers understand that whether they know it or not, they are funding two school systems in our state, and the one is, you know, closing in on a 10-digit figure in the state budget. Can you give us a little background on the challenges that public schools face in Texas?
Oh, yes. I'm so glad that you're covering this topic. You know, this is a new terrain for Texas with this private school voucher program. You know, for Texas has over 5.5 million students in our public school system, pre-K through 12. We serve largest population of emergent bilingual or English learner students. Over half of our public school students are considered economically disadvantaged. You know, we're really diverse and we have a lot of needs. And Texas, unfortunately, has always fallen behind the curve in properly funding our public schools. This was a founding issue for the organization I work for, IDRA, establishing fair school funding across our 1,200 school district and charter schools now across the state. And for many, many years, for decades, we fended off proposals for a private school voucher program until now, unfortunately. And there could be a whole segment on the ins and outs and politics of how it happened. And that might be, you know, part of your questions. But essentially, we're going to hit the ground running next school year with a starting point of a $1 billion private school voucher program. And taxpayers in Texas will be funding two school systems going forward with our now, it'll be a universal and statewide private school voucher program.
And I'm wondering, when you talk about the background of it, I know that here in Wisconsin, the way that we have to remind people is it never grew as a standalone issue. Anytime voucher schools would be put up as a standalone bill, it wouldn't pass or it would get vetoed, or if it was a referendum, it would be taken down. But year after year after year, Republican lawmakers, usually with some Democrats, would insert it into the state budget as something, you know, one of those bills that has to pass. And so by and large, the growth of voucher schools has never been something that's been debated on its own merits. And as we said, it has over the years now been to this point where we're looking at the experience in other states and wondering what it is we might be able to do to stop this from becoming, you know, such a behemoth. But before we get to what we can do, let's continue just emphasizing where we are in Texas and other states right now. I'm starting to see a little bit of even Republican legislators in some of these states going, well, I support, you know, school vouchers. I support private schools. But as a fiscal conservative, I'm starting to get a little bit of concern about how big this is getting. Is there any evidence like that in Texas right now, or is it still full speed ahead for those folks who basically have a blank check for the voucher school program?
Yes. So our private school voucher program is authorized under what was Senate Bill 2 from this past legislative session in the spring that ended this spring in 2025. So this is our rulemaking year. We haven't even seen this fully hit the ground. This program is actually housed not in our education agency. It's housed within our state budget office and the Controller of Public Accounts office. And so they just authorized the organization that's going to be administering applications and providers. It's going to be Odyssey, which is a major tech firm out of New York that's done some of these programs. But there was a lot of pushback in the back and forth in the debates. And this proposal died in 2023. It was a major fight. Like you said, a private school voucher program in 2023 for us was tied to a major school funding bill. And we came back for four special sessions after the regular session ended, the most in Texas history in one calendar year, they had a final giant bill, House Bill 1, that had all the bait in it. It had funding for schools. It had increases to the per pupil allotment, basic allotment. It had teacher pay. It had accountability changes. It had all this stuff, and it had a voucher program. This is fall 2023, and there was a motion on the House floor from a Republican, an outgoing Republican, rural Republican member to strike that article from House Bill 1, to strike it and take out that voucher portion, keep all the school funding bait. And they had the votes, it passed. So then the author took down the whole bill, right? So that was the first time we'd seen the voucher program get to the House floor debate. Our Senate has been passing these out, you know, no problem. But it was the first time we got to the House floor and it died. Now, then we saw a wave of political pressure that got a fair amount of coverage. Millions of dollars coming in from outside sources to the Texas governor to support Republican primary challenges in the spring of 2024. And they were successful. And they got a new House composition of Republicans that were going to be pro the private school voucher program. And so entering 2025, it was pretty hectic. I mean, we had the bill coming out of the Senate in the first couple weeks of session, which, I mean, you can appreciate. Normally, you're just talking about budget, you're assembling committees. They had it going on in January coming out. And in the House, that's where the fight was always going to be. And so what we ended up seeing, what we knew was going to happen, was there was still a holdout of particularly rural Republican members in Texas who knew this is going to be real harmful to our school districts, and they knew what they were hearing from superintendents and teachers and families. And I, in the final, on the day of the vote, they were going to make a motion to have a push it to a referendum in November, put it to the voters, as some other states have done. And the president called the GOP caucus. They put him on speakerphone. They had a caucus meeting the morning of the House vote. And he said, get in line, ultimately. I mean, this has been covered. It was brought, you know, it was put out. And it took a call from the president. And they got in line behind the vote. Two Republicans voted against it on the House floor that evening in April. So there was a lot of holdout till the House debate. But ultimately, I think politics won.
Well, yeah, because they obviously, if they're ready to go in January, then you clearly have outside groups that are doing their homework and are trying to put something through. This is hardly anything that's organic at all. And it's where special interests, you know, have the money to be able to hit the ground running and ram these kinds of things through. We're talking to Chloe Latham Sykes from IDRA, the Intercultural Development Research Association out of Austin, Texas, about the growth of school vouchers and taxpayer funds for them. And so at the heart of some of these Republican fiscal conservatives getting alarmed at the price tag of it. Now, of course, in this case, they were primaried and they were bounced so that the special interests protecting private schools could get their way. But I wonder if, Dr. Sykes, what we learned in there is the path forward is really all about information, making sure not just that these fiscal conservative legislators understand the cost, but that all of their constituents, that all these taxpayers understand. I feel like that's the part that's been missing here in Wisconsin, is enough messaging to help people understand that, hey, nobody's against private schools per se, but it's about our tax dollars going there. Is communication the path forward, the best path forward, or are there other avenues as well?
That was key. That was absolutely key. And the fact is, we know we had a 21-hour committee hearing in the House. That might send chills down your spine about this bill. And it was hundreds of families coming out across the state to say, please don't do this. We know. And that was bipartisan. There was bipartisan pushback saying this is actually not fiscally conservative. The starting point is $1 billion. It's estimated in the first 5 years to go past $10 billion. Again, we're going to see how it's implemented next year. But people understanding it has no real accountability for academic and student achievement or financial accountability. The company that's not been chosen to run it was kicked out of the Idaho program because of fraud. And so spreading that message and the research around these programs are bad for student performance. They are bad for taxpayer accountability. They're bad for state budgets. Just look to Arizona, who has been scrambling over their ballooning private school voucher program. That was a key part of the messaging. And that monitoring and research is something we're going to continue to be lifting up and trying to continue to message. I mean, people feel it. We have school closures going on left and right. And even with some school funding that came down in the legislative session as well, I think the pressure of this program and how it'll grow, as evidenced in other states, is going to be felt very deeply, very quickly.
So what are your next steps? What is the IDRA working on, and how can people learn more about it?
Yes, we have a basic infographic. If you go to our website, idra.org/news/TX voucher law, just to see some of the nuts and bolts of what it is. We have been trying to push people to engage in the rulemaking process of, hey, this program's getting implemented. Your voice still matters, to put some guardrails on this thing. There was just a first round of rules that came out, and there's going to be more. So trying to get people engaged. If they subscribe to idra.org, they'll be able to receive all our alerts and infographics, data dashboards, and additional research that we put out to show how this will affect public schools.
And there are all kinds of good, active people with the Wisconsin Public Education Network who I know are taking all of everything that you said to heart and will be looking for all kinds of other ideas to partner in ways that protect our public schools in Wisconsin and Texas and beyond. Chloe Latham Sykes is the Deputy Director of Policy for IDRA out of Austin, Texas. Dr. Sykes, it was a pleasure meeting you. Thank you so much for so much background and inspiration going forward.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care now. When we come back in our next hour, we will be talking to Chuck Collins from the group Patriotic Millionaires about the billionaire class in this country. And how do you keep them from, much like the voucher school program, from gobbling up everything? And it involves making some fundamental changes to the system. But again, people got to know about it. And Chuck Collins is trying to do his part. I'm Pat Kreitlow. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.